welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick, and today we're working on our CISSP, and specifically, we're going to be taking a look at Code of Ethics, understanding what the heck ethics is, how that applies to us as a CISSP, as well as we're going to take a look at differentiating between policies and procedures. And here to help us with all this is Mr. Adam Gordon. How's it going, Adam?
It's going good. Good. I'm excited to talk about ethics. So ethics is actually really interesting, right? It's one of the things that as a security professional, sometimes we struggle with. And the reason we struggle with it is that it's hard sometimes to figure out the correct thing to do, right? And this is not just in security. This is generically in the real world. We sometimes struggle with knowing what is or is not acceptable, not necessarily correct, but what is appropriate and right given the circumstance. And ethics helps us to figure out how to guide through this and do what we need to do as security professionals to figure out how to navigate those waters that, you know, sometimes can be a little unsure. ISC Squared has a code of ethics, so we're going to take a look at that right now, actually, on the screen. We're going to put that up for you. It's going to be important for you as a CISSP candidate to be aware of the code of ethics. We're going to zoom in a little bit here and take a look at the code, and we're just going to move, just kind of center it on the screen there. And the code of ethics is going to be something you're going to want to go out and take a look at. You're going to want to go to the ISC2 website. Specifically, when you go out to ISC2, if you just either search on the website for code of ethics, or if you just want to generically use Google and just in the Google search engine put in ISC2 code of ethics, it'll take you right to the link. You just bring the code of ethics up. You'll be able to read it. You should definitely read it at least once or twice before you take the ISC2 exam for the CISSP. Want to make sure we know the what's called the preamble, and the preamble is down towards the bottom of the screen. We'll move down a little bit, and we'll be able to zoom in just a little more, hopefully, and be able to see that. And the idea, basically, I'll just read it off to you generically so you can kind of have a sense of what it says. The safety of the Commonwealth, duty to our principles and to each other, requires that we adhere and be seen to adhere to the highest ethical standards of behavior. Therefore, strict adherence to this code, the code of ethics, is a condition of certification. In other words, as a candidate to become a CISSP, you must understand or ascribe to the code of ethics. And as a matter of fact, when you apply to become a CISSP, you actually sign your application. And part of that is signing off on the fact that you will uphold and abide by the code of ethics as a certified professional. So all of the people worldwide that are certified by ISC in any certification, not just CISSP, are going to ascribe to and hold up or uphold the code of ethics. And the code of ethics, as you can see below the preamble, is made up of what's called the code of ethics canons. These are the main points that specify what kind of behavior is accepted by those and is expected from those that act on behalf of the organization. The first bullet point there, I know it may be a little tough to see. We'll zoom in a little more so we could try to see that. Make that just a little bit bigger for you. Let me just go ahead and read that off to you while we're zooming in. So protect society, the Commonwealth, and the infrastructure. In other words, making sure that we are focused on the greater good for everybody, right? Everybody has to be safe. Everybody has to be secure. We have to make sure that people as well as infrastructure are safeguarded. Want to make sure we know that it is very important to safeguard information, but even more important to safeguard life. And we always put life safety above anything else. So if, for instance, there was a scenario where you were given a problem and there was a choice between saving a person and saving information, you always want to save the person, even if you don't like them very much. You always want to save the person, right, before we save the information, right? So just keep that in mind. Be aware of that. The second bullet point down, act honorably, act justly, act honestly, responsibly, and legally. In other words, at all times, always make sure you are aligned with whatever the legal requirements and whatever the specifications around acting legally are going to be. If the law of the land says you're not supposed to do or engage in this behavior, then the code of ethics says, hey, you're not supposed to do that, right? We follow that. We take our lead from whatever the standing legal requirements may be. And remember, as we've talked about in one of our other segments, right, the idea is that there may be different legal requirements in different geographies around the world. what is legal in the United States, what may be legal to do here and engage in as behavior may not be acceptable in other places for a variety of reasons. The reasons are really obviously very important for us to be aware of, to acknowledge, to understand. But what's equally important is to understand what the letter of the law stipulates and act accordingly. And that's what the Code of Ethics tries to imply. Third bullet point down, provide diligent and competent service to principals, making sure that we do our job. We show up every day. We do the things that we're supposed to do. If we have a job that involves making sure we understand how to manage the firewalls, then we have to be trained and we have to be up to the task and make sure we do those things. If we don't know how to manage the firewall, then obviously making sure that we get that training is part of making sure that we are diligent and that we are carrying out and acting competently with regards to our service to principals. And finally, the last bullet point, advance and protect the profession. You know, making sure that we act honorably is not just about making sure that we do the right thing. It's about making sure that we never put ourselves, our company, our customers, and ultimately our profession in a bad light. So we often talk about, although we don't talk too much about it in this particular body of knowledge, but generically, you often hear many security professionals talk about ethical hacking and the ability to be able to understand how to take on the mindset of a bad actor in order to become better at protecting the infrastructure and the information that we're charged with making sure is secure. And this is acceptable behavior, given very broad parameters about knowledge acquisition, given very specific behavioral prescriptions about what we can and cannot do with regards to ethical hacking. This is the kind of thing that is going to fall into this category, advance and protect the profession. It's perfectly acceptable to act in that way, but to do so following all the other guidance the other three parts of the Code of Ethics canons provide to make sure we don't go off and hack into systems without permission, without the knowledge of the stakeholders, without written authorization to do so, and to always do so in a way that never puts the information, the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of that information in any way, shape, or form at odds with the mission objectives of the organization. In other words, you should never hack into production systems, execute denial of service attacks to validate a vulnerability and therefore render the system inoperable. That would be unacceptable and inexcusable even for an ethical hacker to do. And that would be not advancing and protecting the profession. So we want to make sure we understand the Code of Ethics, want to make sure we understand what the thought process behind acting honorably is, because as I said at the beginning of our conversation, you know, sometimes it's hard to know. It's not clear, right? And if we're not sure, we have to have something to fall back on, some sort of moral compass, if you will, that helps us to understand how to act in the proper way. And if we're not quite sure, right, there may be a little ambiguity there, gives us the guidance and the boundaries broadly to say, hey, this may be acceptable, but you know what? I may want to step back and think about this, whereas this other stuff, probably not acceptable. I shouldn't be engaging in those activities more often than not. So this is very important for you to think about, to understand. I will offer you following guidance in regards to this. I would say that it is incredibly important for you to be aware of the Code of Ethics. I would say that, as I indicated as we started the conversation, that every member of the ISC squared or ISC 2 community has to subscribe to and indeed agree to uphold the Code of Ethics as part of their application in order to be able to become a certified professional under any of our certifications. And if you are not familiar with the Code of Ethics, you're doing yourself, the profession, and all of us that do understand and uphold the Code of Ethics a disservice when you represent us to your customers. So it is very important for you to be aware of them and to obviously act appropriately as a result. So think about that. As we continue our conversation, it's not just about acting ethically, acting honorably, acting justly, but using some information within the organization to help us to zero in on what that means, we have to define some additional terms. We're back to that idea of terminology again. Fun to say, even more fun to talk about. So when we think about terminology, right, we're really thinking about vocabulary. And what we're talking about here is the idea of understanding and documenting in our minds what information is. And let's talk about that briefly for a second and broadly. We've talked a lot about confidentiality, integrity, and availability. But how we apply that is going to differ in certain situations, meaning availability of a system, a computer, this laptop that I'm using here, the infrastructure we're using to be able to broadcast the signal to you so you can watch us talk about this and interact with us in this regard is going to be different in terms of safeguarding that, providing availability, than it is when we talk about making sure that a piece of data is available to users using a proper access control list and user account control or some sort of factor of authentication. So while they both mean availability, there are different mechanisms and different tools and approaches we use. So documentation generically of what they are, how that documentation is written, is it accessible, is it available, is it easily understood? These are all things that documentation has to match up to, in other words, be measured by. But the general concept of documentation is important. I often meet with customers. I spend a lot of time working with them when I'm training them, when I'm consulting with them to figure out how to do the things they need to do, right? And when I spend time working with them, one of the key things we focus on is how good is their documentation. Is it up to speed? Does it encompass all the things that they need to be aware of, they need to know about? If it does, great. If it doesn't, what can we do to improve that? One of the most important areas that an information security professional interacts with and focuses on is documentation. One of the areas that's in the most need, ultimately, more often than not in most businesses, of some love, care, and attention is documentation. Right? In other words, we all know it could be better. We all agree, without fail, we could do a better job, yet it's the one area that, knowing all that, we tend to still not focus on. And this is, I think, an endemic issue. It's systemic, in other words. It is broadly based, I think, in the culture of what we call information security today. And without getting up on my soapbox, generically, I will say that all of us, myself, Mike, all of you, anybody that's interacting with us in any avenue across any system here, as we talk about these things, whether it's with a customer, whether it's you learning from us, whether it's you ultimately going out and talking to your customers, I think all of us would be able to stand with and ultimately agree with the thought process and the statement that our documentation can be a little bit better, a little bit tighter, a little bit more focused, and as a result, can ultimately do us a better service by representing our information more clearly. With that in mind, there are some things that help documentation become more narrowly defined, more narrowly focused. There are terms, right, that we have to understand besides the general concept of documentation. But first, let's play a little game, right? This is for you guys out there listening to us. Mike and I played this game before we got started today. I won't tell you what he scored. Really low. Zero, right? So I'm going to ask you to self-assess. All kidding aside, what I'd like you to think about for a minute is the following. On a scale of 1 to 10, right? 1 being the lowest, 10 being the absolute highest. Couldn't get any better if you tried. You're all lying, by the way, if you say 10. Thought I'd throw that out there for you. So on a scale of 1 to 10, how good do you think your documentation inside your business is today? Whatever documentation you have, whatever you know of, because there may be a lot of documentation you don't see and you're not interacting with. But generically, how good do you think it is? When I ask my students this question in class, typically, on average, I get somewhere between a 5, anywhere from, let's say, maybe a 4 to a 6. 5 on average is about the rating they give themselves. When I ask customers, I'm sitting across from C-level executives having these conversations. When I ask them, if it's just them in the room and they're being honest with me, the score is substantially lower more often than not, because they know that there's a lot of work to be done. And they understand that although documentation is very critical to what we do, it's effectively, literally, the storybook, the playbook that tells the story of the business and what the do's and don'ts are, they also understand that, unfortunately, just because of the frenetic pace of business today, we can't spend enough time focusing on it, even though we know we need to. And this is one of those must-haves. I often talk about nice-to-haves, need-to-haves. This is not a need-to-have. This is well beyond need-to-have. This is a must-have. Must-haves are that extra super special category of need-to-haves that you just really can't run your business without. And documentation today is probably the biggest sore point, the biggest Achilles heel that the average organization suffers with and has to deal with today. So I want to think about that. When we think about documentation, we think broadly about some terms, policies, standards, guidelines, and processes, right? So policy, standards, guidelines, and processes. Let's define those four terms. Let's talk about what they are. When we think about policy, right? And we think about what policy is. We think generically about policy being a high-level strategy, a high-level statement of intent. It is a 50,000-foot view of the world. It is not going to be very specific, but rather broad in its scope and coverage. And as a result, it's going to give direction in terms of where we want to go, but not the specificity of how to approach the actual steps needed to get there. And so what I would say, for instance, and we probably all have examples of these in our workplace, at least most of us do anyway, we may have a usage policy that tells us how to be able to plug in and use the internet through our business computers, right? So we have some sort of usage policy for the internet. We may have a mobile device management policy that tells us how to manage cell phones or tablets or things like that, whatever they may be. We may have, as I hit the bottom of my laptop and knock my key off to the side, we may have policies that deal with how to remotely access information from outside if you're a telecommuter or a worker that works remotely, right? So these are examples of policies, probably one or more of which you may be familiar with, and we tend to see a lot of those. On average, security professionals probably have anywhere from 10 to maybe as 30 or 40, maybe as many as 30 to 40 policies they may be responsible for managing and dealing with today in the average organization. As a CISSP, you're going to be asked to write policies. You're going to be expected to understand what they are, how to frame them. If you're not familiar with how to do that, if you don't have a good working example of that, this may be a good idea for you to take a look at. I'm going to give you a URL. You can go to sans.org. We may want to bring up the SANS webpage, and we'll do that in just a second for you. SANS.org, sans.org. And at the sans.org website, what we're going to find is that they have a documentation program that we can actually go into. They have a documentation library. And when we do that, or when we go, we take a look there, we could see that they have all sorts of templates that we can download from the document library. So if you're struggling with trying to find a policy template for an email usage policy, or web server management, or whatever it may be, right? Those kind of things. We can go out to the document policy library, and we can go ahead and we can actually download any or all of those documents. They're going to be available for you. And as a result of that, we actually then can use them. And the nice thing about them is they come in both Word and, there we go, right there. We come in Word, or they come in rather in Word and PDF format. And you could simply download them as you're looking at the screen and we're scrolling down there for you. You could just click on one of the links. Whichever one it is, doesn't really matter. They're broken out by category, as you can see. And when you do that, they've got a listing of all the policies. You can see them there. And we can click on either the PDF or the doc link. Shows up, takes just a minute to load. It's got a, you know, kind of a search interface. You can go in and say, you know, it says like whatever you may have to put in your information, you know, insert company name here or something like that. All you do is cut and paste. Put your information in, and then you're able to use those policies free of charge. And we like free. Free is good. You obviously give credit where credit is due, right? Somebody lets you use something for free. You make sure you tell people where you got it from. So make sure that you let them know, right, that you got it or you were able to download the policy from the SANS reading room. But the point is, ultimately, they provide about 30 to 40 policy templates that are out there for you to start with. And this is a great way to kickstart that thought process about developing policies, because one of the challenges a lot of information security professionals have is ultimately that they're not quite sure how to write one. You know, and as you saw, as we just quickly scrolled through the policy template, you know, it was a couple of pages in length, maybe 2 to 3 pages on average, but there's a lot of language in there, and you know, there's a lot of stuff documented in there, and it may be hard to understand what to put in there. When we think about policy, remember, we're thinking about this high-level statement of intent. We're translating our strategy of the business requirements, into an actionable document that people can go out and actually create opportunity to be able to then consume goods and services through. And so policy may be tough to draft at the right level. You know, is it too high? Is it too general? Is it too low, too specific, too much detail? For instance, we wouldn't mention the name of a specific messaging platform in an email usage policy, but rather say generically, we have an email system. And we're going to give access to that email system through both the web, as well as on mobile and handheld devices, and desktop and desk-bound devices within the organization. That's the right level for policy. Not we're going to use a Microsoft Exchange or Google Gmail system, web only, in order to access mail. That's not going to be stipulated in the policy. Policy should be broad in scope and broad in coverage. And then the detail comes from some of the supporting documents that we'll interact with, and we will ultimately slip in below that. So want to make sure we understand the right level for policy. When we think about standards, we think about the ability to be able to look to external guidance, perhaps regulatory or legal guidance that somebody or some entity or some group, a country or whoever it may be, is offering us. And as a result of that, we need to align with and support them. So for instance, we may have, as we said, something like in the United States, HIPAA, or we may have Sarbanes-Oxley, what's commonly called SARBOX in the U.S., which is a financial services set of standards that detail for publicly held companies that are traded on the stock exchange what the financial reporting and financial regulatory requirements may be, so that we understand how to have visibility into their action and understand that they're acting honorably and justly. reference the code of ethics we talked about earlier, right? So that would be a set of standards that we could reference. In the healthcare industry, as we said, in the United States, it would be HIPAA. And there are others as well, but HIPAA is the main one we talk about. Overseas, we talked in one of our prior conversations about privacy and the role of the law with regards to privacy. We would look at the EU Privacy Directive, 9546, as an example of a standard, right, a law that is in place that we have to be aligned with and follow. When we think about procedures, we think about specific tactical guidance, step by step. How do I break down what I need to do? And as a result of breaking that down, how do I then have the guidance necessary to be able to go out and execute tactically on the strategy, the vision? So for instance, if we stick with our email example, and our usage policy is all about email, in the policy, we would stipulate high level. We want to have a messaging system, an email system. We want to give both web access and mobile device access remotely for teleworkers, as well as fixed desktop access within the organization. Three different ways that we will provide email support and email interaction. In the procedures, we will have detailed documentary guidance that allows us to stipulate exactly how somebody logs on through a web browser, what web browsers are supported, what is the URL, what level of access do they need in order to be able to log in, are they an authorized user, do they need special permission, is there more than one access control, if so, how do they gain access to that system, do they need both a username and a password, as well as a secondary factor of control, a biometric scan of some sort, or perhaps a PIN or something along with a smart card, whatever it may be. We'll provide all that guidance, and all of that is going to be stipulated step by step in almost like a cookbook fashion, right? And it's going to literally be the step by step process that we go through to execute that request, in this case, to gain external access via the web to an email platform. That will be the procedure in question. And when we think about guidelines, we're thinking about something that is optional, right? Guidance, guidelines are optional things that we can look at. They may be beneficial. Maybe it's a set of best practices from a vendor. Maybe it is something that people that are knowledgeable have come up with and said, hey, this will be good for you to do. But it's not going to carry the force of a regulation, the force of law that we must comply with, or there are penalties. It's a, hey, if you want to do this, this is good. But, if you don't want to do this, that's okay as well, right? So we would say a guideline is optional, right? It's going to be typically best practice recommendations, but you're not going to be forced to follow them or else. It'll be very important for us to think about.
Very good information there, Adam. That is a lot of information to try to digest. We went over ethics and the code of ethics. We talked about ISC Square's code of ethics, very important for us if we're going to be taking the CISSP exam or any of the ISC Squared exams, that we understand what that means and what we have to do to uphold that code of ethics. And we also saw the differentiate between policies, procedures, standards, and guidelines. Some people try to use those terms interchangeably, and as Adam has shown us, they're definitely not the same. Each one has a specific purpose, what it should be covering, and if we're expected to write those, which we will be as a CISSP, maybe to lay that framework for some of those policies and procedures, we need to understand what should be in there. And we got to look at SANS.org, a great place to start if you're new to writing some of those policies and procedures. You don't even know where to start. Go there. They've got some templates. They can get you started down the road to writing really good policies, procedures, and guidelines. So, Adam, absolutely, we thank you for all that information. Remember, if you want to attend one of Adam's classes live, drop us an email at cadam@itpro.tv. Signing off for this episode, I'm Mike Roderick.
I'm Adam Gordon.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care.